many people who also I like to thank when I present this project. One was Joost Gurkens, who's a Dutch graphic designer who worked with me on the project. Also Annie Vehevara, who's a former student of mine from BAS, who worked on this project for a year on the drawings. And also a group of BAS students who helped me on the drawings, so I can see some of them here tonight. So it's really nice to see them also. Basically, the project is in two parts. There's a book that you could say is a slow book, which is more about text and about photographic evidence and historical evidence. And then there's a fast book, which is more, let's say, an exploration around how one looks at documentation of urban spaces from, let's say, a series of urban territories to urban spaces that we see here to urban objects. And objects that are also dissected and try to be explained through the book, as well as trying to dissect kind of conceptual frameworks in the work that I'm going to talk to you about. Also, the book tries to show how these environments try to produce desire in the sense of how they construct it as kind of lifestyle products. It also tries to explore aspects like a kind of operational calculus of how these spatial products function. It explores their histories, their cultures and atmospheres, their quantities, and so on. So I'm going to try to talk a little bit about, give you a background of the project, and I'm going to also try to, at the end, link it a little bit together with the work that I've been doing with students and a research project with the Ministry of Housing in Denmark, where I hope that will be some kind of bridge also for us to talk about this question of aging in a Nordic context and maybe also in a Norwegian one. So the starting point, let's say my interest, as Tuve mentioned, is how demographic change changes our cities and changes, let's say, our understanding of how the space around us performs to an older age group, to an older population in which we see this kind of massive transformation of the age composition of our countries, of our societies. That is not only, as I understand it, a kind of quantitative shift, but also a kind of qualitative shift. And this qualitative shift that I've been interested in has been described by Bernice Neugarten and Peter Leslett as a kind of change in the way our life is divided, or our lives are divided. So they describe that before, around 1950, our lives were organized around three phases, what we could call childhood, adulthood, and old age. And they describe resulting from two main things. One is that we grow and live longer. The other one is that retirement as an institution becomes more common in the more developed countries. And this produces a kind of differentiation between a younger old, which Leslett calls the third age, and the older old, which he calls the fourth age. And so this group, I think, is interesting because according to these theorists, it's a kind of unprecedented life phase in our lives. It's a life phase that is liberated from the responsibilities of childhood and adulthood. So the idea of us having the responsibility to be educated and socialized into society, and also the responsibility of working and caring for families and so forth. Yet at the same time, it's free from the kind of constraints of the final phase of life, which is normally associated with physical or mental degradation or decrepitude. And in that sense, obviously these theories are very much about the more developed countries rather than the less, where we see quite different situations. And this has been, let's say, discussed in many different ways. Let's say the dominant discourse around this aging question is the idea of a kind of crisis, a fiscal crisis, that's around the crisis of dependency, where we see more and more older people supported by fewer and fewer younger people. So the notion of a kind of crisis of the welfare state and a crisis of the nation state in fiscal terms. We can say also there's a second crisis, the idea of a kind of programmatic crisis of our cities, where they were designed at a time when our populations were much younger, and now they're, let's say, having to perform for an age group that is much older. So we see, as Olle Baumann has suggested, a shift from needing less of this to more of that, which I think is quite an important and relevant challenge that we face in all of our societies in the more developed countries about how we program our cities, how they perform. My own interest is, let's say, more around what I'm referring to as a third crisis. I would call it a crisis of precedent. It's the notion, according to Lesnut and Neugarten, that this new phase of life is without precedent in terms of how we define how someone should live, where they should live, with whom they should live, what the kind of structures would be for such a phase of life. And therefore, let's say by definition, it becomes a kind of phase of life that is experimental in producing new forms of subjectivity, new forms of social collectivity, and what I'm most interested in is sort of unprecedented forms of urbanism that and architecture that kind of unfold from this unprecedented life phase. So, in a way, you know, we can talk about the idea of a new form of subjectivity in this sense around the notion of a body that is undergoing a kind of constant state of adjustment, correction, and tuning in response to this notion of a gradual decline. We can talk about similarly this idea of new forms of social collectivity outside of the kind of classical idea of the nuclear family or the workplace as the way that we structure our relationship to others, also in a new relationship to the idea of family. And then what I'll talk about mostly is the idea of a new form of spatial conditions, new spatial conditions that, let's say, supplement those that we're more familiar with on the left-hand side with different formats. There are examples of them here on the right-hand side that I'll talk about. And these, let's say, traditional formats where we understand the idea of the multi-generational household or the idea of the institution or the idea of one's own home within which one ages in place, these are very much architecturally scaled phenomena. What I'm interested in is how these transformations become actually very large in scale. And what I look at, and I'll just give you just a brief sort of survey very quickly through some of these cases and maybe then reflect a little bit on them. They focus on three historical examples in the US and then four cases around the world. And I'll just introduce them very briefly. One that maybe a lot of you are familiar with, as Halper was mentioning, is the notion of this coast of Spain as a site of retirement. It's been called the retirement home of Europe, where large numbers of northern and western European retirement migrants migrate to live in this quite large-scale urban structure that becomes a kind of linear metropolitan system. One that, let's say, produces a very particular relationship between the notion of demographics and urban form. So this is just for atmosphere, but these dots that you see here represent 20 non-Spanish EU citizens who are registered and living along Costa del Sol. And they estimate that there's something like double to three times this number in actuality because many people don't register here. And what's interesting, I think, is that they exist within this kind of these bubbles, enclaves that are referred to as urbanizations, which are the kind of pink and kind of beigey bubbles that you see stretching out along the coast between these historical town centers that were formerly largely fishing villages. This kind of urban structure is largely different forms of housing that are organized around different kinds of small-scale commercial and entertainment centers. And from my perspective, what is remarkable about these is the way that they function as relatively mono-national enclaves in which you would have, for example, entire enclaves largely occupied by British retirees, within which they're able to live very much a kind of cultural life that functions according to the logic of their home country. Yet at the same time, there are different structures in place that kind of ensure a sort of exoticism of this Spanish local condition. And in many ways, there are many interesting things that go on around how they position themselves and their own subjectivity in relation to the location that they are based in. For example, many of the retirees, the British retirees, are very, let's say, dismissive of British tourists and see them as kind of stupid tourists that know nothing about the local culture. And yet they kind of move in between these different roles in the way that they also socialize largely with British people in this context. And this has different formats, and just one example I've shown here is the idea of a kind of schizophrenic architecture in which the interior functions as an Irish pub and the exterior functions as this kind of ensuring of the exotic Spanish indigenous architecture. A second site is located in Japan. It's called House Ten Bosch, which is referred to by John Henry, a sociologist, as a theme park to end all theme parks. It's operating along the same lines as many other Japanese cultural parks, which are based on translating or transporting foreign townscape and architecture from one location to a Japanese location, where they undergo particular kind of transformations in this process. For example, it gets lower so that the airplanes can fly. It's too close to the airport, so they had to take 10 meters off the tower. But from my perspective, what's interesting about this site is that it actually hosts a residential complex that is occupied by largely Japanese retirees living within an environment that is themed according to the logic of Wassenaar, which is an area, a canal residential area near The Hague in the Netherlands, where you see in this area in the foreground Wassenaar, and then you see the spaces of the cultural theme park in the background. And basically these, in a similar way, these residents, let's say, mediate a kind of urban framework between the logic of a kind of Dutch village with, let's say, European-inspired architecture with fireplaces, European-style beds and so forth in brick houses, and, let's say, the expectations of a kind of Japanese social and kind of cultural city. You see here, for example, that they use, we see here in Wassenaar, that these residents are using the space of the theme park, of the cultural park, as a kind of space of everyday life. So they go there to shop, to watch people, to recreate, to make hobby things and so forth. And I think this becomes a very interesting, let's say, relationship between, let's say, a kind of simulated place and the way that it gets appropriated in a kind of Japanese context. And we see, for example, the notion here of how one can see it at the kind of intersection of two important transformations. One is the idea of the theme park reacting to a kind of demographic condition, where in this case, rather than focusing on theme park activities for the young, it's focusing on cultural activities for the old. And at the same time, the idea of introducing the logics of the entertainment industrial complex to the idea of a retirement community. So we see this literally in this case, the transformation of the retirement community from, let's say, a rest home as a kind of typology to the idea of an event landscape, kind of event landscape that's designed to use up leisure time. And at the same time, a move from roller coasters for the young to cultural experiences for the old. The third case that I'll touch on is the senior recreational vehicle community, and maybe some of you who have traveled around the U.S. have seen these things, or maybe even traveled in some yourself. I think this is very interesting in the sense that it has a particular scale, and it's been estimated to have between 2 and 3 million American retirees who sell their home and live year-round in these kind of interiors here. This is, let's say, maybe one of the larger ones where you see these things slide out from the walls. What happens in a sense is that in giving up one's own home, there's a kind of, you could say, a kind of compensation that takes place. The idea in this case that all of these interiors become extreme, let's say, manifestations of the kind of tropes of the American middle-class interior. That we see that in all of these kind of brochures and magazines that try to sell this lifestyle. The RV community is based around particular kinds of infrastructure, obviously the physical one of the road system, and also how people use different kinds of parking spaces and parking environments. But also importantly, in the last 10 years or so, this environment has developed as a kind of internet-based social network that is organized around these internet-based clubs. So you can see here a range of different clubs. For example, the Good Sam Club has around 1 million members, the Escapees Club over 100,000. These clubs become, let's say, the major organizing network for these clubs. And some of the clubs online, for example, have this kind of situation technology where you can track where your friends are and you can leave messages and people arrange to meet up. You swap recipes. There's kind of endless amount of information swapped around this platform. And this produces, I think, quite interesting kind of intersections with space in the way that it organizes, let's say, different forms of instant urbanism in the top left and the bottom right. it relates also to the way it kind of lands within existing urban environments. In the case of this location that's called Quartzsite, these dots that you see here are actually representing RVs during the month of January. This is at one moment where there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of RVs parked in the desert, producing a particular kind of extraordinary, let's say, instant urbanism. They also kind of camp out in Walmart parking lots, where I've spent maybe way too much time hanging out with RVs in Walmart parking lots. And then the fourth example that I'll talk about is the Villages of Florida, which is the world's largest retirement community with over 100,000 inhabitants, which developed largely during the 1980s just to give you some sense of the scale. Sun City was formerly the world's largest retirement community. You see the second from left. And then you get an idea of the scale in relation to Manhattan, for example. The structure of this urban setting is very much around a structure of leisure. So the idea of what we were trying to show in these drawings is how leisure organizes the territory, both in terms of landscapes for golf, but also for recreational centers, and so on. The basic structuring of the unit of the village is around the notion of security, the idea of around 55 to 60 gated communities that you see here, that also are organized around these recreational centers of different scales, that are also organized around three different downtowns. They're called downtowns, which are basically areas where they will have nightly free music, dancing, happy hour for 4 hours, and these become the kind of main social centers and commercial centers and entertainment centers for these environments. And when you zoom out, you also get a sense of the idea of how it's trying to relate to a discussion of producing a square urbanistically, yet at the same time functioning very much according to the logic of the mall in the context of the relationship of parking to this kind of urban structure. And we see also in the case of the villages a very interesting understanding of time. The idea in this case that this location, in this case, that was built largely from the 1990s, is producing a completely artificial history. So these are historical plaques that were developed in the 1990s in this town square, which tell the story from the 1800s of what took place in these environments. All of the public spaces are themed according to the idea of being located in a history that never actually existed. So collectively, what I argue is that these experiments challenge, let's say, the dominant ways that we've been talking about age and the city, age and the elderly, and how we deal with discussing housing. What I would argue is that these logics that we see on the right-hand side don't replace those on the left, but add a kind of supplementary discussion that relates very much to how the market has responded to the emergence of the young old as a kind of, let's say, opportunity, outside of the logics of how we traditionally understood the notion of care and welfare for the old in our societies. And from my perspective, this quote, I think here from the lyric, is very much, from my perspective, a kind of question of ambivalence, that my own kind of position in relationship to this is about ambivalence between, on the one hand, understanding these situations as a kind of escapism, so a kind of escaping society, and on the other hand, let's say a kind of emancipatory project, to emancipate oneself from the idea of how we should live in the last years of our life, how we should emancipate ourselves from the expectations of being a well-behaved old person. So let's say if we talk first about this idea of escapism, which is very much a quite clear critique of these situations, I would locate these situations at the intersection, on the one hand, of a kind of neoliberal spatial practice, on the one hand, together, let's say, with demographic transformation and how these have, let's say, articulated a kind of escapism from responsibility in terms of supplying and offering products that could, let's say, enable this escapism. And in this sense, it kind of operates, in my mind, as a kind of fourfold dystopia, a dystopia of segregation in which we add age to the things we normally talk about, which would be income or ethnicity. It's a dystopia of securitization, largely, in the sense that many of these environments are based on a kind of paranoia associated with security logics. A third one would be a dystopia of privatization, in the sense that they all relate to the idea of the potential of private governance and self-determination in the sense of privatization. And the last one, I think quite importantly, is a kind of dystopia of denial, denial of these final stages of life. So many of these environments are based on ignoring this very last stage of life, and many of them you're not able to live there or survive if one is, let's say, physically or mentally disabled. And just to give one very short, let's say, example of this idea of this dystopian aspect of these environments, but one thing I would talk about is the idea of segregation in relation to how the market as an instrument has worked in a time of late capitalism. And I refer here to a very important essay from the 1950s, which basically argues for a shift in the way we construct products and how we market them and how we think about how we buy and sell and construct products, which comes from Wendell Smith. And to make it kind of hopefully quick to get across, what Smith proposes is a shift from the idea of mass-produced products that would be, let's say, sold in small amounts across the entire society, across too many different kinds of consumers, and argue for an increased efficiency and profitability in the second idea, which he refers to as the kind of deep slice of the cake, which is the idea of let's say, generating instead very specialized products to a very segmented and specialized consumer. And what, of course, this meant is that one had to understand different kinds of consumers and to be able to, let's say, develop products specifically for this particular consumer. And I think this shift, you could explain, let's say, most clearly through comparing the Model T Ford, where you could get any color as long as it was black, this idea of a mass-produced, mass-marketed product, to how cars are generated and marketed now, in which the user of the car is a segment, is designed first, and then the car is designed around this very, very specific user. Of course, the logic is that many more cars are sold to Antonella types versus the Model T that would be sold to kind of everyone in smaller amounts. And this becomes, I think, very relevant in discussing these environments, and I'll try to explain that. These instruments that are used to produce segmentation, where we see, for example, the Nielsen Prism instrument, it produces 66 different segments of our society, in this case, in America. And, for example, the one that's used in Denmark and Norway has 33 segments, but it's very similar. And what it does, for example, is produces a profile around these different segments and constructs that around different kinds of data, what people buy, how old they are, and so on. The three main, let's say, parameters are age, income, and urbanicity. So urbanicity is about the idea of how far one is living from a center. And you can see, for example, here mapped out in these three, the vertical line is income, this is age, and this is urbanicity, with the most urban. So all of these dots are existing in this kind of three-dimensional space, which tries to describe all of America's consumers. And then this is used usually by different producers or suppliers to locate in our very heterogeneous cities pockets of homogeneity. So the idea is to try to read amongst this very heterogeneous mess, to try to read homogeneity within it. And what I think is let's say, remarkable about the environments that I'm showing you and talking to you about is the kind of shift in which, rather than these tools producing, looking for homogeneity within heterogeneity, which is a kind of reading of the city using these instruments, what it does actually is write entirely consistent segments of a singular type of person in very large numbers in space. And just to give you an example here, if we look at some city or if we look at the villages, it's highly, let's say, dominated by one or two, in some cases three segments out of 66, which represent a very similar, let's say, age group and income group. But when you go into these segments, it's extraordinary in the level to which homogeneity operates. So in this sense, it's been discussed by different players as relating very much to a logic of also consumerism. And in this case, the villages and the developer own most of the media, the local media in this environment. So they own the radio stations, They own newspapers, magazine, they own also television. What happens in this case, of course, is that this becomes an extremely efficient market to buy and sell goods without any messages being wasted on young people or people who could not afford it. So it becomes an extraordinarily efficient instrument for constructing a market in which there's no noise and no failed signals in buying and selling objects. And this, in the case of the villages, the developer owns all of the commercial real estate and owns a large amount of the businesses, such as the golf cart dealerships and so on. What this means also is that this completely transforms political and democratic representation in this environment, in the sense that the developer has a monopoly on all of the local messages around local politics. So if anyone disagrees with the developer, they get no airtime and they're completely attacked in this local media. And this becomes, let's say, an extraordinary discussion around privatization, private government, meeting market segmentation, meeting discussions of how this relates to both, let's say, political representation, but also resource allocation, in the sense, in this case, of environmental stewardship around water resources in the villages, where because of the water use, a great deal of water use being developed for golf courses and so forth, one sees a kind of amazing sinkhole phenomenon starting to develop. So there's some, let's say, extraordinary and remarkably problematic aspects that lead to a discussion of unevenness connected to this kind of societal escapism. So that's one side of the story that I think is very important. I think the other side of the story, which I'm going to try to open up also, is this idea of the emancipatory project, the idea that even though we can be very skeptical about these approaches and environments, I would also like to touch upon the kind of utopian project built within them. Utopian in the sense that we talk about a utopia of climate. So this is the geometry of paradise, which refers to Juan Pablo Casado's imagining of these zones of kind of ideal climate. We can talk about the kind of utopia of youthfulness, which is based in the villages on eliminating youth. So one can feel youthful if there are no youth around. So this is the village's cheerleaders at the opening of the village's Olympic Games. We can talk about the utopia of golf, Costa del Golf, Costa del Sol. A kind of utopia of exotic European refinement and high culture in the case of the Japanese Haustenbosch. And you can talk about, in the case of the RV community, a kind of utopia of the sublime of nature and the freedom of the road that we see in these kind of environments. And I think we can talk about the kind of banality of these utopian ambitions, but I think at the same time it's also important to let's say, look at the resonances between these utopias and our kind of historical condition, in particular, let's say, the project of Haki Grant's Instant City project, where the work that they were doing to try to understand the potential of kind of attacking or challenging the city as a kind of permanent, static, and a hierarchical object, for them was a possibility to reconfigure this through infrastructure. So here we see infrastructure as a kind of, let's say, vehicle to allow for the possibility of bringing urbanity of London or New York to the fields in which these log plugs and rock plugs would be, excuse me, located in different locations. And I would say that, you know, we see that very much playing out in the possibilities of how Quartzsite operates, and the way that this kind of instant city challenges the way that we think about relations and space, the way we think about how hierarchies work in this kind of hybrid constructing space together. That obviously was a condition in Archigram's vision of the possibility of technology meeting the possibility of a kind of liberation from the city as we knew it. And I think also this kind of utopias play out in other interesting ways, where they also kind of collapse and produce another condition. And the idea of the utopia of the vacation that never ends in the villages, where you go there for the vacation that will never end. That for many of them, because of the kind of isolation spatially from the environment, it's quite about an hour and a half to Orlando, we see here, and not a very large city here, that what it means is that many of the people in the villages actually work. So because of its isolation and the sheer scale of the villages, it's produced a kind of new work market in which the senior residents are working, some of them for economic, to be sustained economically, but many of them also as a kind of hobby. as a kind of new form of socialization through a second career. And this is an example of a couple. One is a retired police detective and his wife, who is a retired school teacher, who started this electronic organ shop where they give lessons and sell these organs. And I think also aligned to this kind of notion of emancipation and utopia is also the possibility through kind of experimentation, the development of many kinds of latent urban novelties. So kind of novelties that relate, I would argue, to this idea of there not really being a precedent. There's not really a precedent for this age group. So this kind of produces, let's say, increasingly kind of instrumental urban forms. This is one example that I call a hospital strip, which relates to this kind of normal American strip mall typology that maybe many of you who have been there would recognize or have driven along, where you drive for a long time with very large signs and sometimes big boxes and small boxes. In this case, it's been reprogrammed not as a kind of retail boulevard, but as a kind of hospital ensemble composed of dispersed clinics that each address different bodily ailments and body parts. The idea of, I would argue, that it kind of diffuses the image of the hospital as a mega building through distributing it into a kind of urban structure that functions in a very familiar way as a kind of leisure practice around the idea of shopping on the strip mall. So you see here different body, let's say, treatments that play out in this kind of structure which, let's say, challenges the idea of the hospital when you can drive along in your golf cart along this kind of environment. Another example of this kind of novelty, urban novelty, that is about this sort of highly instrumentalized urbanism dealt with, kind of dealing with one demographic group, is the idea of the golf cart infrastructure in the villages, which incorporates kind of pathways, bridges, tunnels, that you see here, that functions as a kind of grammar of movement that maybe we're familiar with in a kind of Northern European context, in the context, let's say, of bicycle lane systems, but in this case dedicated toward the golf cart and the different speeds of these different systems between the automobile, in this case, and the golf cart. Which also has, let's say, implications architecturally with the idea of the golf cart garage, a kind of urban architectural mutation. It has a kind of cultural presence in the villages around different kinds of activities, including golf cart drill teams, for example, the development of kind of competitive instincts around the world's largest golf cart parade. What is interesting about this kind of mobility system is how it kind of bridges the performance of different mobility systems. The idea that in the case of the villages and in Florida in general, you don't need a driver's license to drive a golf cart. So you actually, it's one way for those who lose the confidence to drive an automobile, or also lose it through bad eyesight or through drinking and driving, for example, that it's still possible for them to drive with a golf cart. And one can also, let's say, understand it in relation to these forms where it kind of bridges, let's say, the spatial capacities of these different formats. A third example is this, what I touched upon is the idea of theming and the idea of historical time that is manipulated through the theming of these different downtowns, which is part of the ambition from the developer to realize the Disney World for active retirees. This is kind of stated in the local newspaper without irony from the developer. And this relates to a very specific, let's say, approach to design that comes from the team who lead design at the villages, the gentleman on the left, Gary Mark. His background is in designing theme parks, in particular Universal Studios theme parks. And he talks about how this is very much the logic of how the villages is constructed around transporting historical periods of architecture and urbanism into these environments where we see this kind of construction of artificial history, the fountain of youth, the kind of construction of post-industrial ruins that were built in a post-industrial period without history, the kind of programming also around a particular time frame and time era, not only in, for example, restaurants, but also, also in different activities from the classic car cruising to different activities that are kind of demonstrated here. What I think is going on in this sense is the idea that the villages is producing a kind of elastic version of time in which the idea of a contemporary is erased consciously in an attempt to try to erase a feeling of relative age between the inhabitants and the environment. So the idea actually is The theme of the villages is called Florida's Friendliest Hometown, and for this particular cohort of retirees, the hometown was a kind of mid-sized American town, largely in the Midwest for these particular people. And this is very much around the idea of trying to reenact this period of their youth, the idea of transporting them back to a time when they were effectively young. And to conclude on the book, what I'm trying to, let's say, make a kind of general argument around is a kind of entwinement between the spatial and the social. An idea that the spatial and the social, in the sense of the idea of relationship between a kind of psychological or lived world and a kind of material world of the city, is something that becomes extremely difficult to disentangle, particularly when one looks at such kind of instrumental kinds of urbanism. And in that sense, I think that different situations that I think are again about a kind of relationship to the kind of unprecedented and experimental nature of this age group and this particular life phase, that it produces situations like this, where we see a kind of medical explanation of the kind of explosion of sexually transmitted infections at the villages being explained through the kind of explosion of Viagra use, through a lack of sex education, and through the low risk of pregnancy in this particular group. And what I would argue is that I think it's part of a larger system. And in fact, the spatial plays a very large role in constructing a kind of life between, let's say, different aspects of this kind of instrumental urbanity. Between, on the one hand, a kind of staged and themed urban setting, which is supposed to send the resident back to their childhood and to their ideal youth period, through concentrating this particular age group, through the idea of a kind of entertainment structure that plays out in the squares. And that's, let's say, connected to a kind of utopia of the suburban dream in which one maintains the lifestyle of the single-family detached house, the idea of the garden city. And this is able to be connected in the context of this kind of party culture, it's highly socialized culture, with the logic of the golf cart and the golf cart infrastructure, and other kinds of prosthetic devices like Big Ox, which is a kind of oxygen product which helps you get past your hangovers that you can buy at the local gas station. So it's a kind of, let's say, a kind of, I would argue, a kind of machinery in which this kind of utopia of the urbanity and the kind of potential of, let's say, the social vibrancy of urbanity is made possible through the concentration of a single group, and it's able to reconcile the utopia of suburbia at the same time. And I think in this sense that we can see these kind of experiments, to kind of close this, is obviously related to the notion of how we understand the potential of looking for